The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lords of Limited. My name is Ben Warney, and joining me on the line, as always, Mr. Ethan Clockwork, percussionist, sax. It's the monkey himself. Ethan, how's it going, my friend?
It's good. I'm coming at you live from the city of brotherly love. We came to Philadelphia for the weekend, but the podcast waits for no one. So hopefully this Airbnb internet can keep up, because we got a lot to talk about with Duskmourn today. How are you, Ben?
Heck yeah, we do. I'm doing great. Marching band contest got rained out yesterday, so instead of getting back at midnight, I was done with rehearsal at 4 p.m. So I had a whole third of my Saturday left, which was amazing, and I was a total bum, and it was glorious. Played some Duskmourn off stream, because this format is incredible.
Yeah, so far, I was saying before we recorded the show, we're only day five, so like let's pump the brakes a little bit, but like this format's delivering. And I think like it's really, really cleaning up some low points in the limited year for me at the end here. And I'm enjoying Duskmourn quite a bit. I'm excited to talk to you about it because we really haven't gotten a chance to talk other than like a few handful of Discord DMs.
Yes. And for anyone who was like talking about, well, Bloomborough was pretty good, you know, it was above average. Get out of here with that. This is what a good set feels like. This is it. Like, you have aggro, you have control, you've got all the archetypes being viable, you've got balance, you've got cool build arounds. Like, give me Duskmourn all day, every day.
Yeah, for sure. That's where I'm at as well. So let's take care of a little bit of housekeeping, and then we'll dive into catching up on this format, seeing where we're at after week one. So first things first, let's chat about the Patreon page, patreon.com/lordsoflimited is where folks can go to give back to the show if they so choose. The show will always be free, but we have some great perks over at the Patreon that we highly recommend you checking out. The base level right now, everybody gets access to the Lords of Limited Discord. It's hopping, it's popping. Limited tech support 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I felt, you know, I often just sort of like I'm a proud pop and I like perch above the Discord, but I decided to get in the weeds a little bit this week, and it definitely felt to me like it was a little bit like everybody was like, dad's here ruining the party. I felt like I was like trying to chime in with some conversations, and I felt like people were like, ugh, here's the teacher. It's like, all right, I'll go back to perching maybe. But it's a great community. I had some questions about some picks and some cards, and I was diving in to the Discord as well. And it's just a fantastic community, especially, we always say it for new set, but we say it because it's so true. For new set season, it is the place to be to crack a format wide open. If you want to be like in the weeds with people who are like-minded, limited junkies like yourself. And we got some great perks as you move up the reward tier rankings as well. All of that is available to check out at our Patreon page, and we want to shout out our new patrons the first week that they join. So this week we're welcoming John Gaspari, Eric's friend, Ken, Sam, Dave Boy, Miguel, Brian, Jonathan, Raphael, Jeff, Josh, and John. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We really appreciate your support.
Yeah, cannot say thank you enough. This format is awesome. Those people know what's up, and they're getting in on the early access.
The next portion of our show notes here, Ben, is a possible data rant from me. I have a rant.
Yes. You messaged me this over Discord, and I just sent you back the Jack Nicholson meme of him nodding demonically with his head. Give it to me, baby.
I'm going to try and spin this as positively as I can, as wholesomely as I can, because there was some... So two things happened to me this week. One was, I think during early access, I had a pretty bad experience, or like was pretty underwhelmed by, what is it called? Midnight Mayhem. Is that the 2 red-white uncommon that makes 3/1/1 gremlins and they have haste and lifelink until end of turn, or haste, menace, lifelink until end of turn? I had a pretty lackluster experience with that card. It felt like it coming down on turn 4 by itself or whatever wasn't that impactful. What I wanted, what I liked, it was in conjunction with other cards. Like if I had an Arabella, then 3 extra power 2 or less bodies was really powerful, or to trigger a vicious clown 3 times in one turn, stuff like that. But just on its own, I wasn't that impressed by. And you know, someone had posted a deck tech in the Discord, and they had I think 2 of those, and I was like, I was kind of underwhelmed by that. I might cut those in this deck without, because they didn't have an Arabella, etc. And then someone else came in and was like, that's like the number 3 game in hand win rate uncommon right now. And I was like, okay, shrug, I guess. But like the thing about it, and not to get too like woke or frou-frou with it, but like it does deny me my truth a little bit, you know? Like I have this experience with the card, and then people are like, well, this like this other thing happens. And I'm like, okay, that can be true too. And it makes me think of something that my therapist tells me, which is like 2 things can exist, right? Like I can have a way of doing something and you can have a way of doing something. And that doesn't mean that one is right and one is wrong, or one is good and one is bad. They can just both exist. And like the data, or the way that I feel like data is used at me sometimes, is like, no, this thing is right. This thing exists and is right. And if you don't agree with that, you're wrong. And I just like, well, but what, there's something to be said with, I've played with this card and it has been not that great. Like on its own, or like, you know, you introduced me as Clockwork Percussionist because I was getting some pushback about that versus Glimmer Light. And like, I like Glimmer Light a lot. I think the 2-mana artifact that makes a 1/1 glimmer is awesome. And like day 1, Clockwork Percussionist was the number 1 game in hand win rate card. And I was like, I don't, this doesn't matter to me because like, I like Glimmer Light a lot. So that's my rant. Like, we can just all like have our own truths and come to, and like the data can exist as well. But like my own experience is valid. That's what I have to say.
That was a very hippy dippy rant. I'm a little underwhelmed, I'm not going to lie. I wanted fire and brimstone. I have a couple of questions for you. So you previously, with regards to data, were on team, if the data says it's good, it is probably a good card.
Yes.
So it does say that about Midnight Mayhem. How do you reconcile that with your feeling that, I haven't been very impressed by this?
Well, I mean, since then, and I will say, like, you know, we're going to talk about, like, you know, everything's viable or whatever. I can only trophy right now with red-white in best of 1. I have 3 I have 3 Boros trophies in the format, and, like, a 6-3 with red-green, a 6-3 with blue-white. But, like, aggro has been what I have had success with in best of 1. Best of 3, I feel like I've cooked a little bit, done some reanimator stuff, etc. But best of 1 aggro is where it's at for me. And I've played with Mayhem a lot, and I kind of stand by my take that, like, on its own, I don't think it does a lot. I think it gets boosted up. I still can't really reconcile it being higher than Arabella in the red-white deck, because like I would never take that card over Arabella ever. It's like there are so few cards I would take over Arabella when I'm drafting red-white that like, I don't know, that's part of it feels like the thing where it gets buoyed up by other cards in the stats, right? Red-white is doing well, so Midnight Mayhem does well, etc. So I don't really know. All I can say is that like, on its own, without synergies, I have not felt very impressed by the card.
I agree completely.
It also might be user error. So, like, there's that too. Like, I could be playing it, casting it wrong, sequencing it wrong, whatever. But, like, it is not a card that I'm like, oh, heck, I'm doing it. I got a Midnight Mayhem pick 4. Let's jump ship for red-white. That's not how I feel.
Yeah, I keep losing to it from my opponents with Sweet Mardu Bruise, where they're like sacking the tokens then afterwards, getting in a chunk of damage. And somehow always, every time it's been cast against me, one of their creatures is a gremlin and like also gets lifelink and menace and whatever. And that also always happens to me with that stupid black-green rare that makes 2 insects that have death touch. Somehow randomly one of their other things is always also a spider or whatever, and I'm just outraged that it's pumping up this other card too while still being busted. But I think the Clockwork Percussionist thing was especially egregious because it is just not that good. It was like the day 1 data, and then for a day everyone was talking about it like it was the truth and the light, and then it's gone now because it is no longer the number 1 card in the data. I don't know.
And that's why I'm just like, it just feels so just have your own opinions and experiences with the cards instead of just like looking to a graph to tell you what's up. That's sort of my feeling. I'm like, I like Clockwork Percussionist, totally fine, but not on its own. Like, I need a painter studio to give it. I need ways to pump it. Things like Glimmer Light, which I will take ahead of Clockwork Percussionist.
Yeah, well, and not to bash Data too much, because if you love Data, you should do your Data life. Just leave me out of it. But I agree that this format is beyond sweet, and so I am even less interested than usual at looking at 17 lands, because I think the format is complex enough that it is going to be very hard for aggregate data to capture the intricacies of the deck building for the format.
That's such a great point, especially at the granular level of commons that are just so, like, aside from whatever, Scorching Dragonfire, like cards that are just like, this does the thing and this is what it is and every deck needs a piece of removal, etc. Like, the cards are all contextual. We're like approaching, you always say like, oh, this format is close to cube or whatever. And it's not that this is, but like, it's close to cube in the sense that I like, data in cube is extremely unhelpful, I think, just because like, everything is viable and it's about preferences and knowing where cards go, etc. And I feel like the same thing is true here. And so I also agree with that like, context matters so much. And I know there are ways to turn the knobs and look at things in terms of, you know, where they belong in certain two color archetypes, but getting that granular with the data is certainly not something that interests either of us. And so, like Ben said, if that is what you want to do, more power to you, and you'll know how to interpret that information much better than we will.
Preach.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Can you think of a time recently when you didn't feel like you could be your full self, like you were hiding behind a mask?
I feel that a lot. That statement really rings true with me, because I feel like I have, like, I'm very passionate about a lot of things that are very disparate. So there's like teacher Ben, and then there's Magic the Gathering streamer Ben, and then there's like golfing, table tennis, sports Ben. And I feel like I interact with a lot of people from those different circles that where there's not much overlap. So there's times I wonder, like, which one's the real me? Because I like them all, but when I'm teaching, you know, there's not a lot of Magic the Gathering talk going on, but, you know, you better believe during passing period, I'm opening my phone and checking Discord. So it's tough to know, like, how all of that comprises to make up me, because oftentimes I'm hiding parts of myself when I'm in each space.
You know, October is the season for wearing masks and costumes, but some of us feel like we wear a mask and hide more often than we want to, at work, in social settings, like what you're talking about, or around our family.
Therapy can help you learn to accept all parts of yourself, so you can leave the masks for Halloween and not for your emotions.
There was a stigma around therapy for so long that it might feel like that's something you have to hide too, but I will say that I'm proud to be working on myself in that way on a regular basis. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge.
Take off the mask with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/lords today to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/lords. And now, back to the show.
All right, let's get into this question we got from one of our longtime members in the Discord. Colin asked us a great question that I think will be a good springboard for the conversation today. He said, this could just be variance, but I've had a bit of a rough patch where I'm not having packs break my way. Like a Great Rooms draft, except besides the three smoky lounges, I only saw underwater tunnels and almost no interaction. I've been trying to approach drafts as find the powerful cards early, then build the synergy around those, but it feels like a coin flip of how the deck ends up more than it has in recent sets. How is everyone else approaching the draft portion? And I felt like this was just such a thoughtfully worded question from Colin, and I know I have an answer to this, and I'm curious to hear what your answer is, Ben. So how are you approaching the draft portion of this format?
Yeah, for me, it's been different than normal. Usually my process for a draft format is find out where I'm the most comfortable, whatever like two or three color wedge or decks that is, or usually it's one color that I like to try to start and then kind of figure out two or three decks that branch off from that one color I like to start and just focus on that early on in the life of the format once I've identified what I think is best for me and for the format. And then, you know, filling out the other decks as I'm forced to when my preferred decks are cut off. That's normally how I draft formats. This one has been different for me. I think rather than steering towards colors, and I am steering towards red a little bit, although I've even kind of stopped doing that lately because I think people are on to the red, white, and the blue, white tempo decks and have appropriate plans for how those decks like to try to attack you. I think in this format, the good cards really matter, but they're everywhere. Like, this format is powerful. It's just not at common. So it's the rares and the uncommons. Like, this is true play booster magic to me. I mean, if you were going to get to the commons that matter later on, but it's basically all interaction and most valuable Slayer for the most part. And so I think you really want to be trying to put the rares and put the uncommons in your deck, and not only put them there, but a lot of the power comes from getting those powerful cards in the right home, surrounded by the right role players to really maximize them. And so I think for my drafting, I've tried to read where my seat wants me to be, as far as, rather than colors, first sorting out, am I trying to get the game over really quick, or do I want the game, like, do I have good cards and think I'm going to have better cards than my opponent and want the game to go long? And then sort of diving into colors there. But I think the number one question you got to answer for your seat is, when do you want to get the game over with? And where do my best cards want me to try to end the game? At what point do my best cards want me to try to end the game?
And you still feel pretty strongly that, like, those two poles are important, like getting the game over with quickly versus wanting the game to go on as long as possible, or feeling like the longer the game goes on, the more likely you are to win, and that middle ground is the least desirable space.
I think it's the least desirable space, but I think, like, for example, I think Black-White Reanimator lives there, and I've played against some great Black-White Reanimator decks. Like, if you get the good rares, the recursion is really strong in the format, and it doesn't have to be specifically Black-White that recurs stuff. But to me, if we were lumping the format into pillars of the format, like, the two biggest pillars are Jeskai tempo aggro decks that try to steal the game, and then, like, green late game decks that just want to go later. I think those are, like, the two biggest, broadest umbrellas you could put the format into. But then there's tons of other stuff in there, plus there's, like, a whole other pillar that I just don't really touch at the moment because I haven't been forced to, which is the Reanimator stuff and other things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could make that other pillar being Abzan, like, late game graveyard stuff, because I feel like that's where Black-White plays as well. But I guess maybe Black-White is more mid-range. I also feel like we owe Shroud Stomper a bit of an apology. I feel like we poo-pooed that maybe too soon. That card has been pretty good. Obviously, if you're ahead, your opponent lands a Shroud Stomper and you can answer it, you mitigate the, like, drain two plus draw card pretty quickly, and if they don't have another way to bring it back. But in any other board state, that card has been impressive to me. Yeah, my feeling for drafts has been, again, around that idea of, like, I want to maximize the powerful cards that I see, and I feel like the way to do that is to get deeper in one color. I feel like the times that I have been tripped up are when I try and, like, latch on to a signpost uncommon too early and get myself into a two-color deck really early. Now, the caveat being that I think there are some two-color decks where you can do that, and I think they're mostly the Jeskai tempo ones, because they are actually supported at common, like red-white aggro and blue-white aggro. I do feel like you can sort of be like, well, I saw an Arabella early and I'm just going to start taking good red and white cards. And usually those colors are deep enough and have good enough commons that you can do that. Same with, like, seeing a Gremlin Tamer pick four and sort of going, well, I have some other stuff that I've been taking, but that feels like the best thing I've seen so far and I'll go after that. When I've gotten into trouble is with some lesser archetypes, some lesser supported archetypes. You could maybe lump Brood Spinner in there, I think. You could also lump the Bookworm in there, though we're going to talk about Blue-Green Manifest Dread, because that is a deck I have a lot of questions about. But the times when I've, like, if I see a Wicker Folk or whatever, red-green, I'm like, I kind of need the juice at higher rarities is what I've felt, because I don't think green plays in the aggro Delirium Stompy space very well at common. And so my best drafts have been when I get deep into one color in pack one, identify that being open, and then give myself a chance to open or get past something powerful in pack two to then pair with that base color and then move down that lane for the rest of the draft.
Yeah, I think certainly that's a recipe for success. I think the thing that is different to me about this format is normally I would have a list of one to two colors that I was trying to get deep into. And I don't really feel that way about this format. Like, maybe I'm not in love with getting in deep to black early, but I would if I opened a great black rare, because there are some banger black rares too, you know? Mm-hmm. So I do think all five colors are pretty viable. Going back to what you said about red, white, and blue, white being essentially soft forcible once you get one of the premium uncommons, I do agree with that. The one thing is best of one is just the worst. I think I'm done for this format. It really is. It's totally the worst.
I need to do a super cut of every format of me saying, when you say that.
Best of one is terrible and I'm done with it for this format. It happened earlier than normal here because of how sweet this format is. And I've had the opposite experience where I've had the most success in best of one with green decks and green late game decks. And lately, especially yesterday, I was watching some football. I was watching Georgia, Alabama, and drafting on my phone. And I drafted several absolutely premium red, white, and blue, white decks in a row. Like, probably three or four drafts in a row, and just went like 1-3, 2-3. Because I was just jamming them into other premium red, white, and blue, white decks that you can soft force in best of one. Like, this format has so much more to offer than that. So I think I'm off the best of one life early because I don't want to, like, I think that is probably your default path through best of one, just because the decks are so juiced, because the format is higher power, the decks at the higher rarities, or not higher tiers, like mythic, diamond, are going to be so much more juiced than normal because the format's more high powered than normal. I just don't have much interest in jamming premium red, white, and blue, white decks against each other all format long. And that just feels closer to constructed to me. And I am not about that life. This format is awesome.
We probably should steer back towards the show notes here and get to some structure. But I've had the same experience you're describing with blue green decks. Like, three times I've drafted what I'm like, this isn't, I got all the payoffs. I have like so much manifest dread. And then 1-3, 0-3. I sent you I have an 0-3 deck in the show notes here that I'm just like, I think this is just variance, but do I just have no idea how to build this deck? I don't know, but I'm sort of off the blue green manifest dread life currently. But let's dive into some more of the, like, how you're approaching, how you're feeling about the format notes that we have here.
Yeah, and I think what I said about Jeskai is true. Like, I think if you don't see the rares, if you don't see good reasons for the game to go long, you should try to steer into red, white, or blue, white tempo. But then the problem with that is you can lose to the better red, white, and blue, white tempo decks, and then also still not be quite fast enough to beat the late game decks. Like, you've got to be fast. And the conclusion I've kind of come to is that if you're playing those red, white, or blue, white decks, you can't keep sketchy hands like that a thing to get there. Like, you have to curve out 2-drop, 3-drop, trick, other 2-drop. Like, your hand has to function to get the game over with quick enough to get under some of the cards that are game warping.
Yeah, you Scorching Dragonfire cannot be your turn 2 play on the play with those decks.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or you're just signing up to lose against the decks that are better in the late game.
Correct.
So for other format thoughts, this format, first of all, should be called Duskmise instead of Duskmourn. Like, I have lost so many games of Magic because I've primarily, other than recently, the last couple days, been the person trying to stabilize, just because that's my preferred role in Magic. And I think there are a lot of sweet decks to cook with in this format. There are infinitely frustrating ways to lose games in this format. Like, the red-white decks, like, there's times I'm at 12 life and I'm like, there's no way they can deal 12 damage to me this turn. And then nope, boom, trick, 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 like 15 damage out of nowhere.
Yes.
It's really, and then there's also the, well, you let your life total get down to 5 or 4, but they hit the fear of burning alive and they dome you out. Or one time I was at 8 and my opponent went back to back fear of burning alive and domed me out from 8. Or, you know, there's the jump scare, the trick that puts creatures in the air. There's just so many ways to steal games. And I think cool that it is like that. I mean, I like that exists. And I like that those aggro decks are good because I think it makes it more special when you do stabilize against them. And I like that the decks that are late game decks get really powerful tools to hang. Like, it's exciting to try to stabilize because you know you get to do something really cool if you do stabilize against those red, white, red, white decks. But if you've not played many games of this format, and you're trying to stabilize, you really want to keep your life total like above 10, probably, against the red, white, and the blue, white decks to really feel stable. Like, once you start getting single digits, the games are pretty stealable.
If you're one of those people who's like, and this is a very important magic skill, it's something that I think I definitely lack, but if you're one of those people who's like constantly like wondering, is this the turn I turn the corner? Or like, oh, I missed that. I want to get in this attack with this like two power thing. Like, that's not what matters in these games when you're trying to be the late game stabilizer deck. Like, it's okay to miss out on your attack with your two drop at some point. Like, in fear of that big swing you're talking about, where you're like, dang it, I really wish I had that blocker back, because otherwise I might not have lost this game.
Yeah. Turtle up if you are trying to stabilize. All,
correct.
All shields to the rear of the ship.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the other thing I think that is cool about this format that we've talked about already is that it's really balanced, right? I think this is probably one of the more balanced formats we've had in a while. And yes, like the stuff at common leads you towards Jeskai, but I think green is better than we thought it was, for sure, or not, like closer to where we originally were before we walked it back. And I don't think the good green cards pull you into green, but green just has a lot of really solid cards, like a lot of C plus type cards that if you're green, like you're gonna see good commons that will fill out your deck if you get good rares. And I think one of the biggest indicators for format health is Marina Vendrell. This is just a fine, good card, like to go after building around in the format. This is a Wooburg 3/5. When it enters, reveal the top 7 cards of your library, put all the enchantment cards from among them into your hand and the rest on the bottom of your library in a random order. Then you can tap her to lock or unlock the door of target room you control, activate only as a sorcery. And it doesn't have to be full on rooms. Like, you can have some rooms plus some eerie stuff going on. This card being viable and good, I think, and not that you want a first pick and go all in on Marina, but maybe you've got some green, and if you're a green deck, you're definitely going to be able to cast Marina, and you will pick it up and put it in your deck. I think that's a good sign of format health, where the premium things to go for are red, white, and blue, white.
Well, you really can go after Marina pack one, pick one, because there is the support for it at common. You've got the Spineseeker Centipede and Moldering Gym at common to fix your mana, plus Terramorphic Expanse, plus lands, plus it's early enough, you know, to go at, like, you know what you'll need to prioritize. And the fact that, like, what you're saying is true, like that is viable. And I do think that's power that you can get. Obviously, if then, like, you know, if you see an Arabella pick 4, you might, like, that's probably a more consistent thing to go after. But, like, you can do it. It's not like you have to shoot the moon with it. I do feel like draft in and draft out, if you pack one, pick one, or Marina, you can get there.
Yes, not, and certainly not what I would advise doing. Like, I would never take Marina over Arabella pack one, pick one, or I would never take it over the black-green spider or whatever. But it's castable and it's good. And I still think this is true about the format for me. This kind of feels like avoiding an aggro trap format to me, like, to a certain extent. I think control is favored versus aggro. Assuming you get rares, I think control's favored versus aggro. I'm getting a giant thumbs down that's very blurry because the lag from the B&B.
My friend Matt sent me a message on Discord, and he was like, the kids are calling opening ley lines for every one of your pack one, pick ones a hat trick. And that's happened to me quite a few times. So I don't see the rares. I just see ley lines. So I have to draft aggro. I think aggro is excellent. I mean, again, my experience has been beating people in with Boros and blue white and red green, and like, yeah, I've done some sweet late game stuff, but by and large that has not been the thing. And it's, I think, partially just because I really haven't seen, I've seen a lot of bombs on the other side of the battlefield. I haven't opened a lot of them yet.
That's what I mean, but that's what I'm saying. I think if you don't see that stuff, you have to be aggro. Like, you have to play those decks. But I think,
well, so don't tell people to avoid aggro.
Well, sure, but if you get good cards, like, I think it's easy for a narrative for the format to be, well, oops, all Jeskai aggro. And yes. I don't think it's that. Like, it's not LCI. Like,
no.
The Sultai space is great also. Or even Mardu, Reanimator, Sack stuff gets there. Like, you just have to hit a certain power level threshold while also having early game defense. And I think if you hit that power level threshold plus early game defense, I would prefer to be on that side of the spectrum than, I think that is actually better than the default Jeskai tempo decks. That's what I'm saying.
We were all about rooms last week, and we haven't said the word yet this episode. Where are you at with rooms in the space? Like, you didn't mention them as pillars of the format. Like, what's going on there? Is that just you think of them as late game decks?
Yeah, that's lumped in with late game decks to me, late game value decks. I also think they're pretty contested. Like, I haven't seen a Smoky Lounge in 10, 12 drafts or something, you know? Like, so for your deck to be a rooms deck, mm-hmm. you have to be the only person at your table who wants rooms. But I do think rooms are still amazing cards in the format, and I'm very high on rooms. I think they change the format completely and are really cool cards. I'm still very high on the rooms that are good.
Yeah, it feels less like a deck to me and more just like rooms are good cards and they're being taken as such. And they just like exist in various decks. Like, you know, you're going to know which decks want which rooms, that kind of thing.
Well, but also like I have a five color Marina deck right now that's got like 6 or 7 rooms in it. And I wouldn't say it's a rooms deck. I have no Smoky Lounges, but you better believe I'm going to get a fair amount of value every time I cast Marina Vendrell. And then they're not all late game cards either, right? Like the red one that is the one in a red attacking creatures get +1/+0. And then you can pay 2 in a red to exile the top 2. That card is absurd. Painter's Studio and Defaced Gallery. Like, there are some that are absolutely excellent for the aggro decks, too. Also, in the white-blue deck, the one that makes a 1-1 glimmer, and then you can unlock it to put a +1/+1 counter on each of them. Those are just great cards for aggro decks.
Yes, I totally agree.
I think as far as color rankings, if we touch back in on that, I feel similarly to where we did last week. I would still go red, blue, white, green, black. But I think green is much closer to the 3 Jeskai colors than I would have thought, and black also closer to green. Like, I just feel fine about doing anything in the format. And then the other thing that I just want to hammer home before we dive into maybe some overperformers and top commons and things like that is that the good cards are really good. Like the good rares really determine the outcome of games. The good uncommons really determine the outcome of games. The commons, not so much. Like the commons don't really swing games. The commons are more your answers to your opponent's cards that swing the games. That's where I feel like the commons come into play. But mm-hmm. the thing about the rares being so good individually is that there's so much recursion if you get good cards and good rares. So something like, say, its name, for example, you mill 3 and return a creature card from your graveyard. That's really annoying if you've dealt with your opponent's rare and then you know it's coming down again, they're going to get another ETB trigger. There's a whole archetype in black and white where if you've got good rares, you can peel the good black reanimate cards or the good white reanimate cards for your bomb rares, which is pretty awesome. There's the room, the Defiled Crypt Cadaver Lab, which we were, I think, a little bit down on last week. But if you've got rares, like, it's not that necessarily so much that it's a build around that you're trying to churn out a bunch of 2/2s. It's more Raise Dead for my rare is what you're interested in if you have a deck with 3 or 4 premium rares. And then our preview card Under the Skin, 2 and a green where you manifest red and then can return a permanent card from your graveyard to your hand. The sheer bulk of all of that makes it so that if you hit a high power level stuff, your opponents are just going to be dealing with those cards over and over and over again, which is, I think, also dovetails nicely into what I like about Manifest Red that I think you haven't experienced quite as much with the deck yet. So if we're talking about Manifest Red as a deck, I think there's two versions of it. And I think when you linked an O3 deck here that does look very good. So for the listeners at home, there's double Under the Skin, there's double Unnerving Grasp. That's the Mana War Manifest Red, 2 Bookworms, a Paranormal Analyst, Growing Dread. Like, you've got all the signpost uncommons. The thing that is missing from this deck when I look at it is you only have 1 Cryptid Inspector. And I think that is the key card for blue-green decks that are just doing the blue-green thing. So that's the 2 and a green, 2/3 common Vigilance. Whenever a face-down permanent you control enters, and whenever it or another permanent you control's turn face up, put a +1/+1 counter on Cryptid Inspector. That is at the perfect home of, like, cheap enough to flip up that you can fit it into turns while double spelling, while also growing into a relevant threat. And it also works so well with each other, right? Like, if you have one in play and you flip another one, like, you're getting the trigger on the first one, and then when you flip it up, the other one's a 4/5, and then you've got a 4/5 and a 3/4 Vigilance. They just stack so well together, and they grow so quickly. So I think that, and the other thing that you're missing is you have no Bashful Beasties. The 4 and a green 5/4 that when it dies, you manifest red. Like, those two cards, I think, are pretty key to, like, the blue-green Manifest Dread deck. And I don't like, in addition to the uncommons, but I, again, that's my least favorite version of Manifest Dread, is straight blue green. But I think those two cards are missing from this deck.
Okay, that's great information to have. What is the version of Manifest Dread that you like?
Blue green, but then playing like premium rares too. Because the other thing Manifest Dread does is, like, you get so much velocity through your deck that you can find your good cards so reliably. Like, let's say you have three rares, and in this deck you have Balustrade Worm, which is great. But that's the 3GG 5/5 trample haste, and if you have Delirium, you can put it back from your graveyard with a finality counter on it. But that's the only rare you've got in this deck. Other than that, it is commons and uncommons.
Let's say
you've got sure. I agree. But let's say you've got three or four rares. Like, let's say you were more aggressive about splashing. You picked up a late card of another color that, you know, goes in the deck. Plus, you've got a couple other rares. Like, my best Manifest Red decks have been, you know, 3 to 5 rares and or mythics. And if you're doing that alongside Manifest Red, you turn through your deck with the Manifest Red cards and stuff like Say Its Name. And then you have stuff like Say Its Name and Under the Skin to buy them back once you get out of the graveyard, and or you just flip them off the Manifest Dread and can flip them up. But you get to the cards so reliably, and then you also get to play the cards that pick the stuff back up out of the graveyard. So it's almost like tutoring for your best cards. If you just zoom through your deck and find the rares and then win the game with your rares. And the other thing that I thought was kind of problematic with the deck was that you could be in danger of just decking yourself. But I've actually really come up on Malevolent Chandelier this week, which is the 6-mana 4/4 flyer, and you can pay 2 to put a card from a graveyard on the bottom of its owner's library. The cool thing about that is if you're churning through your deck, you can use that to then stack the bottom of your deck, and I think that's real in this format. And the other thing that's really nice is you can say its name it back without decking yourself that turn. Like, because by this point in the game, you also have just billions of lands on the battlefield also, because it's really easy to get land value in the format. So I think that is the other thing that Manifest Dread offers that's even better than the blue-green version. And I think the blue-green version really wants Cryptid Inspectors, even more than Bashful Beasties. But Cryptid Inspectors in multiples is pretty key. But then the rare version, you just find your rares and you recur them and you cast them over and over and over again until your opponent submits.
So two things. One, your love of Cryptid Inspector and Bashful Beastie when you're straight blue-green makes a lot of sense to me, because I think that then leads me to something that I haven't been thinking about, because I look at, you know, the deck that I linked here, that O3, that's like 2 Bookworms, 2 of the ways to get creatures back in Manifest Dread, that, like, I'm like, oh, I can grind and get to the late game, but, like, I'm grinding and getting to the late game with 2/2s, and that doesn't win the late game. And what you're talking about with having the Cryptid Inspectors and the Beasties is, you know, you're gonna have some big threats and you can beat down pretty quickly, and, like, they got to trade with your 5/4 and then you get a 2/2 that's synergistic, etc.,
while you're getting value. Yeah, you can just ram your creatures into their side of the battlefield. Correct. Until, like, they can't handle the onslaught anymore. And, like, you want the land cyclers in this deck also. So your top end in this deck is one of each of the blue and green land cycler plus 2 Malevolent Chandeliers, which is the 4/4 that puts things on the bottom of the library. But the other awkward thing about those cards is you get really choked on mana when you do Manifest Dread into those and your plan is to flip them up. Like, taking a whole turn to flip one of those up is not great.
Well, it's great if you're the beatdown, but not otherwise.
Yes, correct.
The other thing that I have found, and I want to pick your brain about, because I saw you play, I think you trophied with this, a blue-green Manifest Red deck that had it was splashing, I think, one red card, the Impending Mythic in red, that deals 4 when it enters or attacks. And I have found splashing in Manifest Red extremely awkward because of how many sources you have to run. Like, I mean, obviously you're splashing a double pipped card there, so you have to run an exorbitant amount of red sources. But, you know, you have to have ways to get those lands back, because you can just randomly, you know, I've had decks where I'm like, well, I've got 2 Centipedes and 2 Moldering Gems. And obviously those are not great cards to have in your Manifest Red deck, so that's a whole other can of worms. But if you have, like, you know, a bunch of ways to splash and a Terramorphic Expanse, and you have, you know, effectively 6 sources with 1 basic, that's not enough, because you can just randomly Manifest Dread into that mountain. And then you're like, well, dang, I got to find a way to buy this back out of my graveyard, or else I can't cast my splash card, and now I can no longer search up that land. So I have found splashing in Manifest Dread to be extremely awkward. And so like there's tension there for me with you talking about wanting to play like a bunch of bombs and splash around in those decks, because I'm like, how do you do it? What's your mana base look like?
I think my mana's generally been pretty good. I've gone, I think, deeper than you, where rather than having one of a land, I've wanted to have like four of my off-color land or whatever, partially for the reasons you're talking about, where it can get milled. But you can also use Say Its Name and Under the Skin to rebuy your lands. Like, you'd prefer to do Say Its Name rather than Under the Skin, but I think you can do that in a pinch. Plus, I've often frequently in the decks that are doing this had, and again, this is luxury, but I've had the thing that turns your land into tap for mana of any color, that room.
Oh, Rickety Gazebo, the other half of Rickety Gazebo. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the other half of Rickety Gazebo, which is nice. Or I've played a lot with the green rare that is the enchantments that die into the enchantment.
Yeah, the one GG, your creatures tap for any color.
Yeah, that one. And then when it dies, it turns into an enchantment. I've frequently played with those cards as well. And so maybe I'm just hitting the whatever 5% and I've hit it a lot early, but I've really liked playing off color rares in Manifest Dread because they're like, you need the power level boost. Like, you need a reason to want to find cards. And I think that's the other thing that this deck is missing. Like, you're not the beatdown plan, but you don't also really have cards that you want to find. But you do have a lot of premium Manifest Dread cards.
But maybe those are, it sounds like you're not really, I mean, those exist, but it sounds like those are not, as far as you're concerned, the important pieces of the puzzle. Like, the more important pieces of the puzzle are beating down, like cards that enable you to be the beatdown, or cards that win the game on their own.
Yeah, I think so.
Which is not intuitive to me.
Sure. Yeah, I agree. I think I have figured out how I like building the decks, and I had the same experience you did, where I was losing a lot early with it. But I do think there is something there, and I think you really want to be able to wheel Cryptid Inspectors if you're in the deck, and if those aren't wheeling, you're in trouble.
That makes sense. No, I feel like I've got some tools to continue to 0-3 with Manifest Dread decks.
All right, let's get into some overperformers here. So first up on the list, just removal. In general, there are a lot of cards that need answering, and a lot of them are creatures. And whether you're the aggro deck, whether you're trying to stabilize, you have to be able to interact with your opponent. My decks that have done the worst, I think, are the ones where I have focused on, okay, I'm going to do this sweet thing. But then, like, if you can't interact, your opponents are also going to be doing sweet things. They're going to have randomly great cards, and you're just going to be in trouble. The removal that is best is the stuff that exiles. Scorching Dragonfire is awesome. The one in a red card where you can pay an additional two or sack an enchantment that exiles, that card is awesome. And for some reason, goes way too late in best of one. I don't know why.
Yep. But, four mana, deal five, exile the thing that if it dies, that's a good card. You just played that card.
Yeah, it's a great card.
Yeah. I think people see it as like, this is a sacrifice card or something. And it's not.
No, it's just a good red card. Yeah. The Land Cyclers also still randomly continue to impress me. And they have not done so for me. Like, I have tried running them after I've been impressed by them, and I just keep having to cycle them on turn two and being mad that they're in my deck and not a land. The only place I've been happy with them for me has been in Manifest Dread decks. But my opponents have, like, I've lost to all of the Land Cyclers at this point. I think I've got the full bingo card checked off.
I faced the blue one, the 5/7 Vigi. And I had I don't know any card names, but the rare white vehicle, one white, when it enters, you exile a thing with toughness five or less. Can't take out the 5/7 Vigilance. So it was pretty much stuck with that on the battlefield, which was a bummer. It's interesting putting this in the overperformer category, I guess. Like,
I think it's just because I thought I was never going to play them or see them, I think.
Okay. Okay.
Not that I think they're really good, but I probably should be playing them more than I am. I just keep having bad experiences with them while also losing to them.
Yeah. Okay.
The black one in Black White Reanimator, like, it having ward discard a card has also been super annoying.
Yeah. It's a real cost for sure.
We've talked about Say Its Name. I think this is the card that I've been on a journey with the most. I think I was pretty high on this card coming into the format and then just basically wrote it off after the first week, and I am now back to pretty high on it. I think it's really good in the decks that want the game to go long, especially if you are Manifesting Dread and or care about Delirium. It's tough because you don't really want it to be your turn to play, But it's really important to those decks.
That makes sense.
Ethereal Armor is another one that we touched on last week, where we were like, eh, if we're viewing the format correctly, this card's going to be great, and it is great. we were viewing the format correctly, especially in blue-white. I think it's primarily a blue-white-gold card, but it hits hard in that deck. But you have to put it in the right deck. Like, I keep having opponents that have played it against me as it being their only enchantment or one other enchantment. It's not going to be great if you're playing in a deck like that. You want to be playing in a deck where you're likely to have 4 to 5 enchantments on the battlefield. You want this to be 1 mana +5/+5 or whatever. And if you're doing that, this card's insane.
It's also insane in conjunction with the +1/+0 lifelink ward 2 exile enchantment. Because, like, ooh, obviously you're like going glass cannony there, but if the ward 2 is already doing work in terms of your opponent not being able to answer the creature, and then you give it whatever +4/+4 in first strike in addition to its lifelink, like, oh boy, is that just tough to deal with.
Well, the other thing is, if you're getting Ethereal Armor for your deck, you're also likely getting the 1 mana flash enchantment that gives a thing hexproof.
Those
cards are best friends.
Correct. You touched on Malevolent Chandelier earlier. I do want to just co-sign that. This is the 6 mana 4/4 artifact that can stack your deck. It can also interacts with your opponent's graveyard as well. So you can mess with Delirium or reanimate if that's something they're doing. Only at sorcery speed, but you can still do that, which I like, because we've had so many iterations of those cards that can't interact with your opponent's graveyard, I had forgotten that it could. And so, like, when I went to activate it and then Arena gave me my opponent's graveyard as the first option, I was like, oh, okay, I can do that.
Hello. Great.
I was still very interested in stacking the bottom of my deck, but I've done that in multiple decks. Like, mostly the things I've done like turbo mill black green that can then stack the bottom of your library, but it's all in the green space, because green just does, like, with Say Its Name and Manifesting Dread, it really can get through the deck quite a bit. You're playing Rickety Gazebo, that mills 4. I've played the black impulse, the 2 and a black, look at the top 4, pick 1, the other 3 into the bin. Like, you can get to a place where you are in single digits of cards in your library, and then you're going to be really happy that you had a chandelier. And it's also nice that it's, you know, a pretty impactful thing to be able to flip up from a Manifest Dread.
Yes, it is also like a clock in the air. It's been unfortunate. Yeah. There's been times I've just won the game with it instead of getting to do the thing.
It's so funny you describe that as unfortunate too, because I'm always like, okay, and then I could do this thing. And I'm like, oh man, you're at 4?
They're 8.
I just have to attack? This stinks. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the best card in the format that we've not discussed yet on the podcast is Fear of Isolation. It says 1 and a blue enchantment, 2/3 flyer, as an additional cost, cast a spell, return a permanent you control to its owner's hand. I think this is the biggest overperformer of the format for me. This is absolutely insane. I think in blue-white, that is its best home, is the blue-white tempo aggro deck. Because frequently you're picking up a room that you've already unlocked and, like, getting double value. It also just gets your creatures out from under, you know, pacifism type stuff that exists running around, or the blue trick that's awesome that turns a thing into an O2, not a trick, the blue removal spell.
Yeah, unable to scream.
Thank you. Swords to Toy Shears. Yeah, Fear of Isolation. And also it pops off with 2 of them. Like, you can loop.
Oh, you can just juggle them and get Eerie Triggers.
Pick the one up, for Eerie Triggers. And it's also just good in late game decks too, because again, you can pick up rooms for value. Like, this being able to pick up essentially 2 cards that you've already used, this is basically, assuming you build your deck right and don't put this in the 2-drop slot, this is double spell while, like, drawing you a card or 2 for 2 mana. It is very, very, very strong.
Yeah, co-sign that. You also have Fear of Imposters on here. That's the 1 blue-blue enchantment creature that has flash. It's a 3/2 with flash. And when it enters, you can counter a spell. And if a spell is countered this way, it's a controller Manifests Dread. This card just puts a stranglehold on a lot of games. Like, if you're even so slightly ahead and you have Fear of Imposters, or if you're ahead and you've already done Fear of Imposters and you get it back, like, you just own the game, because you get to sort of, like, you know what kind of card you're gonna have to counter, and this just allows you to do that.
Yes, and I think just nerfing something into a 2/2 is also great. Like, there's a lot of rares running around. If you stick this against a rare, I think we initially thought, well, Manifest Dread's really good, you don't want to let your opponent Manifest Dread. It is and it isn't. Like,
it's not, you counter a thing, and then if you're against a Rooms deck or whatever, like, your opponent just flips up land and Moldering Gym, and they're like, cool, this doesn't matter. Like, it's really, you have to, like, think about all the work you're talking about with me being like, how do I make a Manifest Dread deck good? And you're like, well, you gotta make sure you're on one end of the spectrum and then check these boxes, and like, your opponent's probably not doing that. So countering their thing into a random 2/2 is probably fine.
Yes, Fear of Imposters is very good for that reason. Another card, Segment from Greater Garbage, turning out to be great. Norrin, Swift Survival, a single red for the 2/1. It can't block. Whenever a creature you control becomes blocked, you may exile it. You can play that card from exile this turn. Card is good.
Say more.
It's just a one drop, which red-white is extremely interested in. It lets you keep turning your creatures sideways with impunity. The red-white deck banks on tricks like whatever it's called, Jump Scare or Turn Inside Out. And so you're presumably going to have those cards alongside while you're jamming with Norrin, Swift Survivalist. It's just a very difficult card to play against, and I've also played with it and been very happy with it as well.
Okay, I'll keep an eye out for it. I think I actually ended up cutting it from my last red-white deck, but in drafting, I was like, oh, you know what you can do with it is Patched Plaything, the 2/1, or the 4/3 double strike that comes in with two counters. It only comes in with two counters if you cast it from your hand. So casting it from exile, it comes in as a 4/3 double strike, which is pretty cool.
And lastly, we already shouted out Painter Studio Deface Gallery. That's the +1/+0 enchantment that also draws you two cards on the other side for 3 mana. That card is nutter butters in a red aggro deck.
Yeah, I mean, because you would just, in a lot of red-white aggro decks, you would just play 2 mana enchantment. Your attacking creatures get +1/+0. And then the fact that you also have divination whenever you want is pretty ridiculous. It's also rare that both halves of a room are so cheap, right? Like, there's only one other one where I think the white one that makes a glimmer and then puts two counters on two things, or puts a counter on each of up to two things, which is also just like why it slots in so nicely to the red aggro decks.
Yep.
So moving on to 10 commons that matter, you know, this is a sort of a recurring theme for us now in the play booster era, trying to peg these in the crash course and touching back in on these. And you're right, there's a lot of removal here. And I'm glad you mentioned exile removal being important, because we do have Scorching Dragonfire on here, 1 and a red, deal 3. And Trapped in the Screen, man, 2 and a white enchantment, the ward 2 on this doing so much work. And the fact that this can target, I mean, it's basically non-land permanent. It's creature, artifact, or enchantment. Have you trapped an opponent's screen in your own Trapped in the Screen yet?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, I'm going to get that on turn 5, baby. Don't you worry. Other removal here we have is Unable to Scream. The single blue, as it Ben said, swords to toy shares. I like that. Single blue, turn a thing into an 0/2, loses all abilities. And Final Vengeance, the single black, as an additional cost to cast, sack a creature or an enchantment to exile a creature. More exile removal right there.
Final Vengeance exiling has been extremely annoying. I have not had the pleasure of playing Final Vengeance yet, but I have lost a lot to Final Vengeance in the red-black space or in the Mardu sacrifice space. It's been very impressive, because I think one of the things that is cool about the late game of this format is if both people are playing haymakers and doing sweet stuff, like, tempo starts to matter a lot, and Final Vengeance being a single mana way to deal with something has just been very, very, very impressive.
Yeah.
And then past that, one more removal spell. We've got Monstrous Emergence. This is 1 and a green for a sorcery. As an initial cost to cast it, you choose a creature you control or reveal a creature card from your hand. Deals damage equal to the power of the creature you chose or the card you revealed to target creature. I'm less jazzed about that one. I almost just made it 9 commons that matter, because it was hard to find 10, which is kind of sad.
Can I interest you in Glimmerlight?
No.
It doesn't matter. It's good. It's a role player, but it doesn't matter in the way that these cards do.
Right. And so Monstrous Emergence is just another removal spell, because I want to hammer home that you do want to be packing removal to interact with your opponent's stuff. But I've had mixed results with Monstrous Emergence, let's say. The two creatures on this list, Most Valuable Slayer, and still as hot on that card as we were last week, 3 and a red, 2/4, gives an attacking creature +1/+0 and first strike. The other creature on here is Spineseeker Centipede, 2 and a green for a 2/1, ETBs, search your library for a basic, reveal it, put in your hand, then shuffle. And if you have Delirium, it turns into a 3/3 Vigilance.
Yeah, we were a little low on this last week, right? We were like, I guess Moldering Gym is just better. Flip back now, huh?
It's different decks want them differently. Like, I'll take Moldering Gym over it if I have great fives, like to ramp into. Like if I've got some good five drop rares, then I think you want Moldering Gym. But more I've found, I don't necessarily care about accelerating. I care about not dying.
Yes.
And so having the body to trade while still ensuring that I hit my land drops, I think I have valued more than the ramp of Moldering Gym. Because if you Moldering Gym into a five drop and then your opponent answers the five drop, the game's over. Whereas like they're less jazzed about, I think, using a removal spell on the Spine Seeker Centipede somehow. I have generally liked the Centipede over the Moldering Gym for leaving the body on the battlefield.
I think that's a good shout, because one of the things we haven't really hammered home is that like green doesn't play in the aggro space, despite being paired with like red green Stompy is one of the best performing decks on 17 lands right now. You know, red green aggro being I think a strong deck, but green not adding a ton to that, and white green I think really just not interested in that as a deck still. That's a take from last week that I'll still stick with. And so green just like isn't playing in any aggressive space. So you're right that like it needs the thing. You can't really afford to Moldering Gym on turn three a lot of the time because of what you're talking about. Like you just got to have a little speed bump there, and Centipede doing that is really nice.
Yes. And then lastly, just, oh, I guess there was another removal spell we didn't chat out, which is Glassworks. Yeah. The two and a red deal four plus the five mana on the other side to start dealing a damage every turn, which has been a real card when you need it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely then won many games off of Shattered Yard. And remember we talked about in the Crash Course, four being the magic number. And so like you're looking at your Scorching Dragonfires and you're Nowhere to Runs and you can't kill Most Valuable Slayer.
Right.
Glassworks is really nice at answering those kinds of cards.
Yes. And then I think lastly here, a trick, whatever trick you want to put there, or maybe both of them belong here. Jump Scare as a single white +2/+2 in flying, and Turn Inside Out as the red +3/+0. If your thing dies, you get a manifest red.
I think people would like Jump Scare more if it was a sorcery, because then you couldn't be tricked into thinking that you should be casting this anywhere other than your main phase and just winning with it. Because I think Jump Scare is excellent. And just the kind of thing you're, to go back to you wanting to call this format Dusk Mize, like Jump Scare just cheeses out so many wins in aggressive white decks.
So does Turn Inside Out. I mean, it's the difference between, like they do different things, right? Yeah. Jump Scare is better if you've got one larger threat. Turn Inside Out is better if you're going wider, because it does push one more point of damage when you put it on an unblocked thing. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on what spot you're in. And oftentimes you're probably heavier red than heavier white. At least that's been my experience. But both those tricks have been very impressive.
Correct.
And weird to say they're commons that matter, because you're not picking those in the first five picks or whatever.
No.
But they are very important pieces of the red white decks, or Jump Scare in a blue white tempo deck, for example. Like you just need really mana efficient things like that to help swing games early on in your favor, or late game to close out games. The fact that they're both one mana is really important to those tempo style decks.
Yeah. Should we take a look at a draft log real quick?
Please, let's do. No, real quick. Why rush it? This format is so good.
Should we take a look at a draft log extremely slowly?
Yes, luxuriously. Let's bask in the glow of this draft format.
Taking a look at the commons, in the context of the commons that matter, we do have one. We have a Glassworks and a Shattered Yard in the pack. Moving on to the uncommons, there's again really one that I like, which is Betrayer's Bargain, that card we were chatting about earlier. One in a red instant as an additional cost to cast it, sack a creature or enchantment or pay two. It deals five damage to target creature. If that creature would die this turn, exile it instead. Have you done the Skull Crab thing? There's a Skull Crab in this pack. Single blue, 03, with Eerie, target player mills 2. This card just feels not good to me.
Well, it's just homeless because the Eerie deck wants to be aggro. It's really tough. Like, maybe you'd play it in a Rooms deck or something. Or, like, I can imagine it being great out of the sideboard, but I don't think it is a plan A type card in the format.
It's so dangerous, too, because, like, if you're not like really doing it, you're just turning on like half the decks in the format by like giving them delirium or reanimate, you know, like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah,
yeah, it's really scary. And then unfortunately, this is a classic rare for me to open, the Tale of Tamiyo, 2 and a blue saga. First three chapters are mill 2. If two cards that share a type were milled this way, draw a card and repeat this process. And then chapter 4, exile, sorcery, instant sorceries, blah, blah, blah. This card's unplayable. You're taking a red removal spell here. What do you like between Bargain and Glassworks?
Well, it's so funny, too, because, you know, you've mentioned not playing the late game decks much. And I looked at this pack when you posted this draft log on our show notes, and I thought, this is the worst pack of Duskmourne I've ever seen in my life.
Like, oh, you just
I just have not been opening packs like this. And I've drafted at, like, as much as I have free time. I have drafted, like, I've got to be 15, 20 drafts in at this point, like, yeah, maybe more if you're counting early access. I have been jamming Duskmourne in every spare second I have. And I've just been playing with powerful cards a lot. Well, facing so powerful cards a lot.
Sounds like I'm due to get some of those packs and you're due to open Tale of Tamiyo.
I think so. But even if I'm opening Tale of Tamiyo, like, you just keep getting past stuff too. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm hot. Running hot. But I think I like Betrayer's Bargain over Glassworks. The deal 5 is nice, and the exile, I think, is the thing that tips it over the top. This would have been a lot closer for me prior to Betrayer's Bargain exiling some of my rares that I was planning on recurring in some matchups recently, but I think the exile on Betrayer's Bargain puts it over the top. Usually I would have said the room and the enchantment synergy, but I think I value the instant speed and the exile more now.
Moving on to pack 2, we do have some power here. 3 very good uncommons in my mind. One is Oblivious Bookworm, green blue for a 2/3. At the beginning of your end step, you may draw a card. If you do, discard a card unless a permanent you entered the battlefield face down under your control, or you've turned a permanent face up this turn. There's a Fear of Burning Alive to stay on the red train. 4 red red for a 4/4 enchantment creature. When it enters, deals 4 damage to each opponent, and has Delirium, non-combat damage dealt to an opponent then lets you deal that damage to a creature they control. There's a lot of, like, cute little things to do with this, you know, like Shattered Yard and Fear of Burning Alive when you have Delirium lets you ping creatures on end step, like that kind of stuff. There's more to do with this than I initially thought.
Well, they also trigger each other. Like, if you stack, if you play a second Fear of Burning Alive, that happened to me. I lost a game that way. It was very, tilted.
Yeah, this card is excellent. One of the 6 drops I feel like that we were high on in the crash course that has delivered. Not many of them have, but this is one that has. And then Optimistic Scavenger, just a powerhouse 1 drop, single white 1/1 with Eerie, put a +1/+1 counter on target creature. So basically you can stay in the red lane with Fear of Burning Alive, or you can branch out elsewhere with Bookworm or Scavenger.
Yeah, this is close, but I mean, this has more been my experience in Duskmourne. Like, think about this pack. Somebody took a card, assuming they're a good drafter, that is better than these 3. Yeah. And somebody is getting one of these 3 cards 4th. Like,
yep.
My experience in Duskmourne draft more often than not has been that your first 4 to 5 picks are absolute bangers. And then sometimes still you get randomly great cards even later than that.
Can if you you've stop read the bragging? This just feels extremely braggy to me.
No, I just, you're talking about I getting to play with powerful cards, and I just have not seen it. I mean, I don't know.
I've played with powerful cards. I haven't played with powerful rares. I have a pile of ley lines in my account, and that's about it.
You're going to be getting those gems unlocked real soon.
Exactly.
But back to earlier in the show notes when we were talking about, like, where do your cards want you to go, right? Like, Bookworm's great. Scavenger's great. Both steer you towards very different ends of the spectrum, right?
If
you take Scavenger here, you are signing up to draft a deck that is going to get the game over with early. Like, even more so than, like, wanting to be white or whatever, it's a bigger decision than that. It's like, which side of the war do you want to be on? Mm-hmm. And then Bookworm, you're signing up to try to stabilize against those white, red, and white, blue decks and win in the late game. Or Fear of Burning Alive, which I like less than either of the other cards because it's 6 mana. Like, yes, there's some value in staying red, but I'm willing to move off Betrayer's Bargain because I think the gap between Bookworm and Scavenger versus Betrayer's Bargain is pretty large. Both of those are linchpin pieces to other decks, and I think Fear of Burning Alive is reasonable. It's just not, I just wouldn't do it. For me, this is between Bookworm and Scavenger, and I think I would land on Bookworm just because I've liked playing those late game blue green decks quite a bit. But the other thing about Scavenger is maybe Scavenger makes more sense as a pick. If you were tryharding here, maybe Scavenger is the best because you can still play Scavenger in white red.
Like, yeah, I have done red white. Yeah, I have done red white Eerie. If you get the, like, certainly Painter's Studio Face Gallery really helps. Like, if you get those kinds of cheap rooms, Glassworks, obviously, like it is, and certainly early, you can prioritize those a little bit more. Yeah, maybe that's the pick.
And Scavenger is single color versus Bookworm being two colors, but basically Scavenger is either white, blue, or maybe sometimes red, white. So it's less clear than otherwise. But personally, I think I would take Bookworm, but I would concede that potentially Scavenger is an even better pick.
Well, I took Fear of Burning Alive here to stay red, and that's like I'll defend that pick now because I will still say the decks I'm having success with are red decks, and getting deep into red for two good red cards, and like it's early enough that I can kind of make Fear of Burning Alive work in whatever color I end up pairing red with. Like I don't have to skew it as so low to the ground aggro because I've got this powerful six drop. I can get a little bit, beefy mid range with it as long as I know what direction I'm going in. So I took Fear of Burning Alive and I'll stand by it. But I think any three of those are viable picks. It just goes back to what you were talking about, where like you just got to know what you're doing. Like take a card here, fine. Take one of these three, fine. But know what you're doing with it.
Yes. And the other thing to like about Fear of Burning Alive is you still are pretty happy pairing red or green with red with a Fear of Burning Alive, like much more interested in the Jund Delirium space with a Fear of Burning Alive.
Right. Right. I don't have to be aggro, even though that's where I like my red decks to be. I don't have to be aggro, especially with a great premium removal spell and a premium Delirium six drop.
Right.
So I grab the red card here and we move on to pack one, pick three, where the power level drops again. We don't get a great red follow-up. There's a Turn Inside Out as the only red card in the pack. Other commons that I like, basically just Unsettling Twins, 3W, 2/2 when it enters Manifest Red. Where are you at on Twins? Didn't make your list of commons that matter. I assume you still like it.
Maybe it should have. I played against this when I was playing, I think, certainly in the best of one meta, where it's like jamming lots of small decks into each other, red, white, and blue, white. My opponent played an Unsettling Twins on 4, and I was looking at my two piggy banks, or whatever they're called, the 3/2 that dies into a treasure, and I was real sad. Maybe it should have been on there. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe that edges out that 10th card, whatever you said you wanted it to be, a list of 9 anyway. And then there's some uncommons that I think we're not probably picking: a Skull Snap Nuisance, blue black for the 1/4 flyer with Eerie Surveil 1, and Cynical Loner, the 1W 3/1 can't be blocked by glimmers, and if it survives to your second main phase, you get to search your library for a card and put it into your graveyard. See, this is a kind of pack I like to see in Duskmourn. Real juiced power level.
This is atrocious. Again, your pack one and pack three have been really bad packs. I care about none of these cards. Like, you could hand me a card from this pack and I would put no weight on it. I think my inclination with the cards that we have is to take Moldering Gym, Weight Room, because I want to ramp towards Fear of Burning Alive. It gets me another enchantment. I want to splash often in my Delirium decks. Like, they do want to be true Jund Delirium, I think, a lot of the time for me. I've had no success with red green Jund beat, or like red green beatdown. That being high in the data is a mystery to me still.
I landed on Unsettling Twins here just because, like, it's so interesting. We're just having such different experiences. But like, when the drafts are low power like this, I'm steering towards Boros because it's a deck I know I can get a high floor of that kind of deck if I'm not seeing the power. Like, sure, I'm not going to hit some ceilings with drafts like this, but I know I can consistently get there. Where like taking Moldering Gym, you're like, yeah, but you're gonna have to see some good rares to want Moldering Gym in your deck.
I that has always come through for me.
I'm so tilted right now. So we take Unsettling Twins and move on to pack one, pick four. You got some cards here. There's a Spine Seeker Centipede, 2W, 2/1 searches up a land. There's a Glassworks and a Shattered Yard. And there's also a nice uncommon Delirium removal spell, a Drag to the Roots, 2BG, destroy target non-land permanent, and Delirium, it costs 2 less to cast.
Yeah, I think so. This is interesting where you're talking about steering into red, white. And I think my default has been to steer into green because you just get so many solid cards. So like, I think I would have gone Moldering Gym into Spine Seeker Centipede. And then I'm thinking, okay, great. I'm green, red base, and I can play anything else I want for the rest of the draft, basically, which has been how I like setting up my drafts that start rocky like this. But certainly after taking Unsettling Twins and knowing we want to steer into red, I mean, Glassworks looks really good as another removal spell. You've now got 2 red ways to interact, and you're, I think, not looking the fastest, which worries me a little bit. But again, we don't have to be red-white at this point.
Right.
We're just red, which is a good feeling.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I really, we'll have to see how like these philosophies shake out, because I imagine we'll probably both get the flip side of the coin in terms of seeing powerful stuff in drafts. But I just really liked, like, I just know I can get some good red cards and I'll figure out the rest in pack two. I'm less excited about taking green fixing cards, assuming I'm going to get to open or past powerful rares, you know?
That's fair.
All right, take us on to pack one, pick five, where we have the titular card for me this episode, Clockwork Percussionist, single red 1/1 artifact creature with haste. And then when it dies, you exile the top card of your library. You can play it before the end of your next turn. What else do we got? We got an attack in the box, 3-mana, 2/4 artifact creature toy. When it attacks, you can give it +4/+0 until end of turn. And if you do, you sack it at the beginning of the next end step. We were shouting that out because that's what I took. I'm sure I'm going to get slapped on the wrist for doing so. There's nothing else here that like pulls you in. Like you want to take in another color, right? Oh, I guess we also should check in. It's in the pack, so we should check in on Duskmourn's Domination. 4 blue-blue enchantment, steal a thing. It loses all abilities and gets -3/-0. That card is awful.
Is it? I was going to say, I kind of like Duskmourn's Domination. I don't really like it here, but I think it deserves to be shouted out because like it's really good against the style of deck I like to play. Like,
because it doesn't kill the thing. It
doesn't kill
it.
The thing, and then you can't reanimate it. It is, It is not, I mean, it's not good, but it's not good. Bad. It's not bad. It's exactly what you said. Like, it's hard to cut it from blue decks.
I've done it. I've cut it for sure.
You've cut it? Okay, so we've come full circle on that. I think it's pretty egregious to not take Clockwork Percussionist here. I think this is an overcorrection to your data hatred of it.
Here's one thing I will say. I mean, I agree. I should take Percussionist here. I think there is a little bit of like, it's slightly awkward having Percussionist and a 6-drop in your deck. Like, there is some dissonance there for sure. But like, I should take Percussionist here. I think Attack in the Box isn't bad. Like, especially I like it in conjunction, I think I've talked about this before, but with a card I expect to get getting deep in red, which is Ragged Plaything, the 1 and a red 2/2.
Oh, speaking of ways to steal games, yeah, good.
That card's insane. But and that's a 2-card way to steal games. You're just like, oops, here's 6 damage that you can't block. Like the fact that this can make Attack in the Box unblockable, then you do the +4/+0. Maybe you've got a Most Valuable Slayer giving it +1/+0. Like, so I know, I think this card is not the right pick here, but I think it's not the worst either. Like, you get two types. I mean, Percussionist gives you 2 types for Fear of Burning Alive as well.
Percussionist giving you 2 types for Fear of Burning Alive, as well as being something you're happy to sacrifice to Betrayer's Bargain, I think makes
that's also the
correct pick.
Yeah, I'm with you. That's fine. I slap on the wrist is fine, but like, people just need to relax about this 1-mana 1/1. It's a fine card.
It's a fine card. I agree. But I think worth noting that pretty early on, you had decisions to go in many different directions. That's the other thing I like about this format is it's refreshing to feel like I have agency about where to steer my drafts without feeling like I'm spewing equity all over the table. Like, that has been a huge breath of fresh air for Duskmourn.
Yeah, even going back to that pick too, like, I mean, I agree. I think Fear of Burning Alive is the worst of those 3 picks. But like I said, I'm fine. Like, looking at it today, I'm not cringing at making that pick. I'm like, that's fine. Like, you got a direction. You know what you want to do. And I think that's a good shout. That, like, I don't feel like I made I've spewed value by not taking Bookworm just because I don't really understand the Manifest Red decks yet. Like, you've got choices that lead you down different paths, not necessarily, again, to go back to, they're different paths, not a right path and a wrong path or a good path and a bad path, just different paths, you know?
Just different paths, full circle therapy. You love to see it. And I do think come Arena Open time, like, it's going to be really important to know how to draft all of the different decks well. Like, this is a format where it really feels like you're going to get rewarded for having all the tools in your tool belt.
Well, and you're definitely going to get rewarded for being like Ben and opening rares in all of your packs.
I'm using my juju too early. I'm speeding.
That's right.
Listen, the format's rewarding me. I have loved the format, and it is loving me back. That's what's happening.
No, it's great. Love to see it.
Anything else before we go?
No, I'm excited. I'm sad that I have to hop in a car and drive 6 hours back to Pittsburgh, but because I won't really be able to draft, but I'm going to get my draft on this week. This format is delivering so far.
Yeah. Two thumbs way up, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, 5 stars, whatever you want to say. Loving Duskmourn.
Mm-hmm.
Great place to wrap us up. Thank you, as always, to Salty Pretzels for our intro and outro music. Make sure you give it a listen.
You can find all of our content on our website at lordsoflimited.com. There is links to an updated tier list courtesy of Mr. Ben Wernie. There's links to our episode backlog, our YouTube channel, which is popping off. I posted 4 draft videos on our YouTube channel this week. So go check that out. Like, subscribe, please. We're very close to 10K subs over on YouTube, which is exciting. You can also find our merch courtesy of TeePublic. Obviously, our Patreon page is available there. Lots of great stuff at lordsoflimited.com.
If you've got any feedback about the show or any questions, shoot us an email at lordsoflimited@gmail.com.
Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week for another episode of Lords of Limited.
Thanks, everybody. See you later.